You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello, and joining you for a special end of year Christmas edition of the Cycling Podcast, and thus providing short-lived respite from the incessant reruns of that festive movie featuring a young Jonas Vingegaard defending his suburban Chicago home from an invasion by a pair of robbers after his family accidentally forgets to take him, their 11 other kids, on a Yuletide jaunt to Paris. Yes, the middle classes had more disposable income in the 90s. My name is Daniel Freeber, and I, over the next hour or so, we'll play the role of McAllister parent to the unruly creche of familiar names and voices that we have assembled for this episode, or slightly boozy rabble, hopefully revisiting some of the 2023 professional cycling season, and hopefully not leaving anyone to fend off the wet bandits in Illinois. Now, we have a starting lineup already on the field of play. Others may stumble into our midst over the course of the next hour or so, or indeed, I may send one or two of the assembled cast back to the stands. I'm going to say welcome and Merry Christmas immediately to Mitch Docker.
Hey, how are you? Yeah, good to be here.
Mitch, I think the only one who answered the call to dress festively, vaguely festively. There might be one other I can see looking fairly sheepish in his Christmas jumper, but Mitch, good to have you with us.
Great to be here. I can feel the Christmas spirit through the lens here.
Pulsing through the airwaves. Welcome and Merry Christmas as well to a rather tired looking Motown maestro, Larry Warbass.
Hey, yeah, good to be here.
We've already established that Mitch and Larry do know each other, and they don't have long standing animosity, although I suspected they might at one point. Welcome as well to another retired pro but very much peaking podcaster, Ian Boswell.
Good to be here, Daniel.
To Boz's main competition for the role of our own grown-up Kevin McAllister lookalike, Richard Abraham.
Hi, Daniel. Merry Christmas.
Neither of them can quite rival Jonas Vingegaard, I must add. And finally, for the moment, I think to the man who was supposed to retire at the Tour de France in the summer and, when asked why he may yet return in 2024, replies Vino. No, it is, alas, not Mark Cavendish, but François Tourmazur. François, how are you doing?
I'm fine. I don't have a Christmas gear, but I brought a little friend with me there. So every time I speak bullshit, it won't be me. It'll be him.
Can you describe what that is, Francois? Because I can't.
It's a little thing, you know, with eyes and a nose. I mean, it's kind of my finger, you know, talking. And I'm sure that I'm going to say contentious things, so it won't be me. It'll be him. Okay, right.
Francois, any vino? For another of the directives that I sent out to the group.
Vino here. It's actually Côte du Rhône from Jaboulet Aîné. And it's also organic wine. Vino is on the menu tonight.
Wonderful, wonderful. We've already established that Larry is at his training camp on the Costa Blanca, Larry. And I said you were looking slightly tired, sounding slightly kind of browbeaten. You told us you were sharing a room with Bruno Almirai, and you're quite concerned that he gets an early night. Oh, in fact, I can see him behind you. You're quite concerned that, well, you both get an early night because you've had a big day already, and you've got more big days, I think, coming.
Yeah, tomorrow's the last day, so that's good. So yeah, no vino for me, just some decaf Nespresso. Unfortunately, a little less exciting, but yeah, you know, it is what it is.
Can you let your head down a little bit over the next week or so?
Yeah, I'm actually going to Hawaii for Christmas, so that'll be really nice. So that'll be a good reprieve, but it'll be good, yeah.
Wonderful stuff, wonderful stuff. Well, chaps, we usually start, as you know, the episodes with a news roundup. We're not going to have one this week because it is a special end-of-season episode, but there is some big news, some huge news, in fact, there has been over the last few days. News that Tadej Pogacar is going to ride the Giro d'Italia, and well, he's also going to ride the Tour de France, attempt the double loss achieved by Marco Pantani in 1998. Just thought we'd have a quick quick survey of you chaps. Good idea, bad ideas, the double on, I did some number crunching earlier today, looked at the time between the Giro and the Tour, 34 days, exactly the same as when Pantani did it in 1998. And Francois, you were probably there in 1998, weren't you?
I was, yeah, I was, unfortunately. I was one of my best, was actually one of my most fascinating Tour de France, 1998, as you can imagine, not for sporting reasons, but for the drug scandal. As you know, podcast listeners might know, I was one of the guys who broke the Festina scandal in 1998. So, yeah, I remember it well, absolutely. And to be honest, I think it's a very good idea. It was about time that Pogacar tackled the Giro. And I'm such a great fan. Yeah, I'm such a fan of Tadej that I think that if someone can achieve what Pantani did in strange circumstances in 1998, it's probably Pogacar. So yeah, I'm looking forward to this.
And Daniel, I actually have it under pretty good confirmation that after Larry and Tadej got into this little debacle last year of Larry catching Tadej in training, Tadej became a big
passing
fan
him.
Of the cycling podcast.
Yeah, passing
him. He became a fan of the podcast as well as his team did as well. And they were they've been listening to your Vuelta coverage on the fact that doing a Grand Tour is the best way to win a Grand Tour. So I think that's why he's going for the Giro, to best prepare for the Tour de France. So maybe you're best suited to answer the question, is this the right decision?
I don't know. We talked, didn't we, when the Giro route was announced. We said it was a sort of soft, it was a bit of a thirst trap for Pogacar, this Giro, with only 40,000 meters of climbing, I think we said. Larry, is that going to make much difference? Is those 10,000 meters of climbing less than the Giro usually has, or 15,000 meters of climbing less? Is that going to help him?
I don't know if it's going to help him win it, but it might help him for the Tour de France, because, you know, maybe it'll be like slightly less fatiguing. You know, last year there were maybe 3 days over 5,000 meters of climbing, which those are the days that really, really just kill you, especially if you're a GC guy going for GC, you know, racing to the finish every single day. So maybe actually it'll make it easier for him to do the double. Whether it's a good idea, I don't know. You know, it's like if he had just won the Tour de France the last 2 years, I'd say, yeah, it's like a sweet idea. But, you know, I still think if Vingegaard, I don't think he's going to do the Giro. And I feel like that'll give him like a little extra leg up on Tadej. But yeah, I mean, I think it's sweet that he's doing it.
No reference to the other people trying to suffer through 5,000 meter stages. Only the GC guys doing it tough up there. The rest of us sort of used to cruise through those stages. This is what I love about Tadej. You know, he's just bringing the old school racing back to the peloton. You know, he's just racing races. He's doing what used to be done, and you know, making it less robotic. You know, and I don't know if that will. I think with a guy like him, maybe that's going to better prepare him for the Tour. Who knows? Like, I think he's one of the guys that he seemed to respond to racing really well, opposed to that robotic preparation for the Tour. You know, Vingegaard, that suits him. I don't think the double would suit him, but Tadej, I think the double might suit him even better than we think.
Yeah, I guess he'll have to squeeze an altitude camp in there, won't he? He'll probably have to recover from the Giro, I guess, then go to altitude. I mean, thinking about Pantani, when he did it, he didn't really know that he was going to do the Tour de France, and he sort of decided about 10 days before the start of the Tour de France. So he was sort of mentally kind of decompressed, I suppose, after the Giro, and maybe that helped. In a similar fashion, I suppose, to maybe Sepp Kuss, went home, and although he knew that he was doing the next Grand Tour, he didn't get too sort of stressed about the next Grand Tour. And as Boz said, well, he found that winning formula, didn't he, last year. Mitch, just thinking about, well, not next year, but the current year, one of the great events, as we move on to talk about Christmas and the end of 2023, one of the great happenings of this season, as far as I'm concerned, took place just a few days ago. And this is where I wanted to start, as we do talk about Christmas and the end of 2023. I wanted you to tell us, kick us off by telling us about the Belgian Christmas. You may have done this on your podcast before, but I saw some posts on Instagram, and, well, my eye and my attention was drawn to the magnificent attire that was being sported. I've already sort of castigated you lot for not showing up in festive attire today, but there was a certain kind of festive attire for the Belgian Christmas. What is the Belgian Christmas?
Well, the Belgi, it's this very famous ride in Melbourne. It started out about 15 years ago. I don't know the exact start of it, but it was just a ride that started in the inner cities of Melbourne where they decided to do a route that didn't include the main roads, and it's evolved over the years. But the best part about this ride is it's called the Belgi, but it doesn't really resemble Belgium in all aspects of the racing there. The only thing, there's only two cobbled lanes in it, but the rest is all mixed terrain. It's grass alleys, it's fields, there's gravel tracks, there's single track, it's everything, and it's supposed to be on road bikes. It's a very fun ride, it's full gas, but the best part about it is there's lots of shortcuts you can take. So if you get dropped, you can just take a shortcut and you can join back in and you can rip it as hard as you want and then just get dropped again and then join back in. So the idea is to complete a Belgi. To complete a Belgi means you don't take any shortcuts. If you get dropped and you take a shortcut, you complete a Dutchie, as we call it. You know, it's like who completed a Belgi today? Everyone has a word about it, and who was on a Dutchie. The Christmas Belgi goes up another step. It's all in dress-up affair, but it doesn't mean the pace is off. It's gaining levels as the years go on. This year, I went in Lauren Fignon's... it's not Super U. System U. Yes. Yeah, System U. And I had the French bands on it. I didn't have the shorts. I was looking for the spectacles. I had a leather helmet on, which was probably a little bit too dangerous for this ride. But anyway, I went for it. All in, and it's really fun to see what everyone comes up with. I love that sort of dressing up that era of bringing back the old feels, the old vibes. The best part about this ride too is it's Christmas feel. We finish with Christmas drinks, but it's 8 o'clock in the morning. So we finish with a beer. I had Life on the Peloton beer there. It's always tradition to have a shot of Ouzo as well. And then you go about your day, 8:30 in the morning, three beers deep, couple of shots of Ouzo. It's a long old day after that, I can tell you.
Mitch, where does everyone get the jerseys? Because as I say, it was a fantastic array of, well, I saw some, the pink Once jersey, I'm not sure which year that was from, maybe 97, around that time, and that was a cracker. There were quite a few controversial Lance Armstrong tributes there as well, in various flavours.
Yeah, best dress went to a guy called Daniel Braunstein, came full Lance, even with an old Trek Madone. Was it the Trek Madone that he used to ride? I can't remember, but his Trek bike, full kit. He even had the yellow jersey edition. Everyone sort of gets it. The thing is, there's this retro cycling kit website, I think, and you can tell when they're remade jerseys. For me, I love to see the original ones, back the old school Nalini ones that are oversized, you know, that box shape cut. If people are pulling them out, you're like, mate, you've done some really good research. If you get the replica, you know, good on you. It's still good, but you want to have that original. I was lucky that I was in my old club in Brunswick Cycling Club. They've got a whole array of old jerseys there. And I was sorting through their old jerseys and I found that System U jersey. I was like, this is it. Gave a donation to the club and took the jersey for the day. So it's super fun. Everyone starts talking about it early on and the research goes into it. You want to... The full kit. You've got to have the full kit. It's easy to get the jersey, but you want to have the Knicks, the gloves, the socks. That's the primo.
The Belgi Christmas, by the looks of things anyway, certainly one of the highlights of the cycling year for anyone who took part. The year 2023 was, of course, the year of Jumbo-Visma's Grand Slam. Mathieu van der Poel, well, managing to avoid arrest, first of all, on the night before the World Road Race Championships, then winning, having also won Milan-San Remo. Year of Thibaut Pinot, Peter Sagan, many more saying adieu. Thibaut's case, Francois, beginning a second career as a PSG football hooligan, judging by pictures from Dortmund last week. But a vintage year in lots of respects. And, well, our next stop in our review, in our very idiosyncratic review of the year this evening, chaps, is, well, with our own highlights, cycling highlights of 2023. We've already heard Mitch about the Belgi Christmas, but I did ask you chaps before we convened for recording today, and what was your best day in cycling in 2023, whether in your own cycling or professional cycling? And Francois, it's a landmark year for you, 2023, possibly your last covering the Tour de France. What was your best day of 2023?
Well, it was definitely my last Tour de France, you know, unlike what you seem to think. And I must say my last day on the tour was an emotional one. I mean, Mitch was not far away. No, it was, you know, as I said, as you probably know, I gave up the tour on stage 6 at my favorite restaurant in the Pyrenees, hotel restaurant in the Pyrenees, Le Viscos. And it was quite emotional because they even had a pâté en croûte with my name on it. I mean, they devised a menu like a Pyrenees stage, you know, with lots of climbs, a few, you know, flat sections, and some, you know, very steep descents full of booze. And it was really, for me, an emotional moment. And I must say my best two moments on the season were in restaurants, which won't surprise you. As we know on the podcast, eating and drinking are part of the cycling world. And the other one, apart from my farewell to the Tour de France, was probably on Paris-Nice. On Paris-Nice, we went up La Couillole, as you might remember, which is a climb that's that there'll be not far from the Tour de France this year as well. Because, I mean, we'll be going to La Couillole on the Tour de France. And at the very top of La Couillole, there's only one chalet, and it's called, it's actually a restaurant, and it's called Quintessence. I'm sure the seats and the tables on race day on the Tour de France will be very, very dear in Quintessence. But if you have a chance, probably not on race day, but if you have a chance to go up La Couillole, dear listeners, and have a seat and a table at Quintessence, even a room because you can sleep there. It was one of the best culinary experiences I had this year. It's absolutely gorgeous. Not cheap, I suppose. I didn't pay. I was working for ASO there. But the place is totally isolated. And it's a real, it's in the mid, absolute, in the middle of nowhere. I think it's run by a Swiss couple, but a great place. So, you know, if you want to go to the final days of the Tour de France, maybe you can book at Quintessence in La Couillole like 3 or 4 days in advance. But I mean, if you spend the stage day there, I mean, it's on the finish line, so you'll be happy, I'm sure.
Well, will you be there as a spectator in 2024? Possibly.
Actually, to be honest, I was planning to find one day where I could just go as a spectator, and more than as a spectator, just to have a night out and a nice dinner and a few beers with you guys, the cycling podcast guys, just to say hi. I haven't picked my stage yet, but I might well do that.
It's a fantasy that we all have, whether it's riders or people who work on the tour as journalists, to just one day do the tour with at the side of the road with a picnic hamper and a crate of beer. But alas, that is an experience that I've not yet had. Richard, you did your first Tour de France with a cycling podcast. You don't have to name a highlight from, and that might have been the low light of your year.
Well, when I arrived on the tour, it was perfectly poised. Everyone was talking it up as this, like, the best race in 2 decades. And then the first stage I was at was the time trial when Vingegaard kind of put it beyond Pogacar's reach, and that was that. Well, he might slip into another category. I think that final stage with Thibaut Pinot was quite something to behold. Like, firstly, the logistical experiment of having the tour finish where it did, out in the Vosges, just the way that there was so much anticipation around Pinot before that stage, so much expectation, so much pressure, and seeing how amidst this kind of quite the emblem of modern cycling, Jumbo-Visma, with all their R&D, lots of investment, and the tour pretty much sewn up, versus Thibaut Pinot and FDJ, the sort of homeboy underdogs almost that were really capturing people's hearts. And I was waiting for Marc Madiot at the finish, who sort of presents quite a, he's got a kind of demeanour, doesn't he? And like a sort of presence, and he likes to project himself in a certain way. And then he sort of just broke down in tears while reflecting on what was the end of Thibaut Pinot's final tour. And just opposite the FDJ bus was the Lotto bus, and the contrast between like the emotion and the attention that was on the Pinot bus and the Pinot party versus what felt like almost sort of like just another day for Jumbo Visma, even though they just won the Tour. And I just that will stand out as a kind of,
you often get that takes me back a little bit to, I remember when Team Sky won their first Tour de France in 2012, and it almost seemed somber around the team bus. I'm sure it didn't if you were part of the organisation and inside the team bus, but there was a real sort of prosaic kind of sense of just a job having been executed, and from the outside it didn't really transmit any of the sort of joy that you would associate with sort of achieving the holy grail in professional cycling.
It was like they didn't lose, you know, it was the sort of satisfaction and the relief of not having lost even though they had won. Whereas for Pinot and FDJ, they hadn't won, but it was the sort of joy of not having won. It was very strange, and it was these two sides of cycling that were there, and almost, well, as we'll get onto, probably a bit of contrast and competition between them, that kind of heart versus head, or like art versus science of cycling, almost manifested itself in like the sort of typical Tour madness of like very small mountaintop finish.
Larry, we did your 2023 debrief a few weeks ago, when we discussed your heroics in 2023 in great detail. What was the best day that you experienced in 2023 as a professional cyclist?
I mean, to be honest, actually, when you sent us the topics, I think you said most memorable day / cycling experience. So I actually chose a memorable, not my best day, but it was very memorable. It was actually, for me, it was probably racing Unbound. I was there with Ian. I think I was just, yeah, extremely unprepared, and it was a surprising day, and it was super hard, and I didn't expect it to be as brutal as it was. And so, yeah, I guess my first foray into gravel, potentially last, I don't know, only gravel foray so far, was probably, for me, the most memorable cycling experience, because it was like I was pretty much alone off the back after about, like, I don't know, 30 minutes of the race.
And I just was traumatized, like, for several weeks and maybe even months afterwards.
That's what I mean, memorable. I wouldn't say it was my best day, that's for sure, but it was a very memorable day. And in the whole, I mean, it was cool to sort of experience that whole scene in the US and, like, see what it was all about, and yeah, how much hype there is around it. And my parents were at the race, so it was kind of like old times. So, I mean, it was a fun experience looking back. It wasn't really fun in the moment, but yeah, for me, it was a pretty memorable experience, I would say. For me, that was probably my most memorable day of 2023. Maybe not my best, but it was my most memorable.
You've hit on something, Larry, because, like, most memorable doesn't really mean the best in cycling. Like, if I think to my own rides this year, like, Daniel, you said what ride or what experience reaffirmed your love for cycling. Like, I really didn't love cycling the day after what was the most kind of memorable ride of the year. But I think that's kind of part of it, is that the experience isn't just, like, the best, the most enjoyable, the happiest.
I love out of that Larry, it was like a new sort of, like, and I'm not necessarily saying you were suggesting this, but I think a lot of people would assume that Unbound is just for the, or gravel is for the has-beens, you know, it's sort of easy, I'll just come across there and win it. And you're like, haha, I don't think so, buddy. This is pretty hard here, bud. Good luck even trying to make it. And it sounds like you got schooled out there by the big boys.
Oh, yeah, I got schooled. Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. Even Ian tried to help me. I mean, he tried to give me all the advice he could, but Ian, he didn't help that much.
if you were to critique Larry's gravel riding and pronosticate Larry's future as a gravel rider, would it be a bright future that you would
see? I mean, I didn't see a lot of Larry in the race, to be honest. I think we, like, both went to take a quick nature break before the start, and Larry's like, oh, so we all just start at the front. I'm like, no, I get a call up because I was on the podium last year. You better get up there because you're going to be 10 rows back. And yeah, I mean, gravel's evolved a lot since even I first came to it. But kind of ironically, my most memorable moment is like the opposite of Larry. This summer I went back and did the Etape Tour, which is like kind of like for me going back into the old days. You know, it was the stage from the finished in Morzine. I think it was stage 14 of the Tour over the Porte Soleil. And that was the first time I'd been in like kind of a big road environment since I left the World Tour in 2019. And as memorable as it was also like, oh my goodness, I can't believe I used to do this, like race down these passes with, you know, really competent riders. There was actually two of Larry's AG2R teammates there. And I was like, whoa, this is like nuts. You know, people think that the gravel stuff is crazy and dangerous, but oftentimes, as Larry can attest, Unbound is really flat. And yes, there are some dangers, but you're not racing down passes in the Alps at 40, 50, 60 K an hour. So that was my most memorable day on the bike personally. And then I think as far as when I look back over the whole season, like the moment that I enjoyed most as a fan, there was a lot this year. But I think one that really stands out to me that I think a lot of people have may have forgotten about was stage one of the Tour de France. And, you know, everyone's excited for the tour, and to see the Yates brothers on stage one go to the finish line together. I grew up racing with my younger brother, and to see that happen, it was like, I wouldn't say it was emotional, but I was like, that is so cool. You know, and to think, you know, their parents and stuff to like have both your kids, not just brothers, but twins, to go 1-2 on stage one of the Tour de France and take yellow. I still can't distinguish them apart, but one of them won. And it was just like, it was a moment that I was like, wow, that is like a moment for me that would stand out. I mean, back in the day we had the Schlecks, but to have two brothers that are so good on stage one of the tour fighting for the yellow jersey was something that, that really stood out for me.
Mitch, we'll finish the part with you. We'll come to you for your highlight alongside the Belgian Christmas in a minute. I'll just give mine. I suppose there were 2 days really which stand out in terms of the intensity of the moment. Francois, I guess you can probably empathize with this. I was talking to someone the other day about memories of the year and also just memories from bike races in general. And you can get to a point where you feel as though your hard drive is full and you feel as though you're in danger of just sort of remembering the same stories from 10, 15 years ago and the same kind of anecdotes. And therefore, you know, particularly the last 7 or 8 years, I've done all of the grand tours and, you know, a lot of days kind of blend into one. So any day that sort of has a higher kind of amplitude, a greater sort of intensity, sometimes it can be the sort of light. I talk a lot, bizarrely, about light quality on Cycling Podcast, but, you know, the colours are more vivid, the sounds are more sort of vivid as well. And one day, which definitely stands out for me in that sense, was the time trial to Monte Lussari in the Giro d'Italia, where everything just seemed to be dialed up to 10, the drama, the emotion, obviously the conclusion itself, the denouement itself with Roglic, where that incredible moment where Roglic's chain dropped and everyone watching on top of the mountain was just convinced instantly that his chance had passed. And we were witnessing another sort of near miss, another example of heartbreak in the career of Primoz Roglic, only for us to discover a few minutes later that in fact he was beating Geraint Thomas. So that day, I think everything about that day, that sort of pierces, that punctures, as I say, that sort of blur, that kind of white noise of just lots of memories over the last few years. And I think that's a day that I will always, always remember. And another moment that stood out for its intensity and just the kind of sense of a sort of mountainside kind of throbbing was the moment where Pogacar attacked on, was it stage 5 or 6 of the Tour de France, on the way to Courtauld. I think mainly because it was so surprising. We'd seen him get dropped by Jonas Vingegaard the day before, and we all thought that that was pretty much the Tour de France done after 5 or 6 days. And it was so sort of in keeping with Pogacar's personality, his showmanship. It kind of came from nowhere. There was this sort of gloom enveloping the mountain, sort of juxtaposed with the, you know, the fantastic colours of the crowds and the noise of the crowds. And again, that was a moment just for its sort of intensity and the way it kind of resonated with me, really stood out in 2023. So that'd be my two. Mitch, what about you?
Yeah, look, in true sort of Belgian fashion, we've spoken about my day on the bike. You know, maybe it was the Belgian, maybe it wasn't. Let's just leave it at that. But I'm going to move away from the tour because there are other important races in the season. And what race do you think I'm talking about? Of course, Roubaix. This year, Roubaix, I think, was an amazing addition, the fastest ever addition. And things, if everyone remembers, things kicked off on stage on Sector 20 Wallers when Jumbo Visma absolutely annihilated the field leading into Arenberg. It didn't happen in Arenberg this time. It happened the sector before. And the best riders went off the front there. I was thinking, what's going to happen from here? It's 100K to go. Ultimately, we saw the duel. We're going to see Van Aert, Vanderpool come across the final sectors there in Carrefour de l'Arbre. You saw, you know, Degen Cobb shouldn't have even been there. He was right up there, only to have heartbreak taken away from him with that crash. And ultimately, Vanderpool going away and winning it because of Van Aert's puncher. You know, was it because of that? Was he going to win? Like Roubaix, every year, it just delivers this race. I just love this race. And this year was, again, for me, I watched that race and I remember why I love cycling because of that drama in that race. So much happens in that one day. And it produces just a beautiful winner every year. There's always a great story to it. And this year was just another great addition. I love
Mitch,
that race.
Do you get pangs when you watch that race? Is that the one day of the year when you still wish you were a professional cyclist?
I don't know. It's like I was watching an interview from Vanderpool recapping this just recently. And he said the same thing before the race. It's such a love-hate relationship with this race. I love it now because I'm not doing it, but in the race, I don't know, it's, you only really enjoy it, I think, afterwards. It's not much you really enjoy in that race unless you're those guys who can cruise across it. I don't know. I guess so I romanticize it now and think, yeah, I wish I was back there, but far out, I would just get my ass handed to me if I went back there now.
Well, we are talking mainly about the 2023 season in professional cycling today, men's professional cycling. The Cycling Podcast Feminine, they've already had their Christmas edition. They had a Christmas quiz this week. I've got a few questions for our panelists later, but more of a review that we're doing. And we are talking about 2023, but thoughts are already turning to 2024. And in fact, as we're recording tonight, the Vuelta a España was being presented. I think it was being presented. Well, I'm not sure where it was being presented. And we'll ask another guest who's just joined us, who's just dropped in, parachuted in, fresh from the Vuelta presentation itself. He's going to tell us where the presentation was and what the route's like in 2024. Rob Hatch, Merry Christmas. How are you doing?
A very Merry Christmas to you all. I'm very, very well, thanks. I'm fresh off the plane about 3 hours ago from holiday. I actually went through Madrid today where it was presented, but I decided to do my best Terry Wogan impression at home. It was Madrid. I thought it was going to be in Lisbon when I switched on because we were severely lacking in the information department. But it was very interesting.
Well, I was going to say, Rob, bearing in mind that we have got potential Vuelta winner on the panel tonight.
I'm looking around. What, La Francois?
Larry Warbass. I'm looking hard at Larry Warbass.
Larry semi-enthused, I think, by that declaration.
Yes. Bearing that in mind, what can you tell Larry in particular about the route that awaits in 2024?
Well, Larry, who I waved at as I flew over him earlier on today, I could see Denia in the distance and Oliva and all those places. Yet we begin in Lisbon, time trial to start. And the big difference this year in the Vuelta is time trial to end as well. Madrid, it's the usual roads, Gran Via, Atocha roundabout up to Cibeles. But it's a 22-kilometre time trial. That's one for you Australians, that, by the way. A 22-kilometre time trial to finish off in Madrid. But in between, there ain't too much for the sprinters, let's just say that. It is a Vuelta, it's the most Vuelta of Vueltas in that sense. They go back to places like the Quito Negro, which is a horrible uphill finish that Dario Cataldo won on before people started looking at changing gear ratios and things like that. He almost had to put his foot on the floor before he got up there with Thomas de Gent. There's Lagos de Covadonga that comes back as well, which is a really nice stage that I'm particularly looking forward to. Picon Blanco is the final mountain stage down. Daniel. It's mainly a Vuelta that starts in Portugal with three stages. We go to Andalusia for the next 6 or 7 days. So it's going to be a hot Vuelta España, by the way. A very hot Vuelta España. There's a lot of Galicia, a lot of Asturias, which I know you
like,
Daniel.
My dream Vuelta.
I would say the last week and a half is your dream Vuelta, isn't it?
I think Andalusia...
Mind you, you're a fan of Agrandissimo, aren't you, so?
Yeah, Portugal, Andalusia and the North, missing out. Apologies to anyone who lives there, spends a lot of time there, but missing out Costa Blanca, Costa Brava, that is ideal for me, I must say. Well, Rob, before we move on, I think there's somebody at the door. A carol singer, maybe. Accendono I brillano
gli alberi di Natale. First of all, dear listeners, I wish you a really Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. So about my wish list for Babbo Natale, my letter, as we say in Italy, Babbo Natale, Santa Claus. Well, no, maybe it can be a surprise for you, but I don't ask for a cycling without cyclists. Not at all. For me, cyclists are not a problem. But it would be sufficient, a grand tour with only mountains near to the sea. So after the stage, I can go to sleep near a beach, and maybe the day after, before the other stage, go for a swim or something like that. Imagine, for example, a tour of Italy only with this kind of mountains, Vesuvio or Etna. What do you think about? I think it's not only a wish list, but a marvelous idea. So not only for Babbo Natale, but Mr. Christian Prudhomme, Mr. Mauro Vegni, Mr. Javier Guillen. Think about this. Believe me, only mountains near to the sea can be the right answer. Merry Christmas again, dear listeners.
Well, there was Ciro telling us and telling, well, Babbo Natale, telling Santa Claus what he had hoped was in his stocking as far as grand tours were concerned. I don't think he's going to be wholly satisfied. Only mountaintop finishes by beaches was Ciro's, well, we heard it there, was what Ciro wanted for the 2024 grand tours. There'll be a few days where I think he'll get his wish. But chaps, we're going to move on. We're going to continue to rattle through our review of the 2023 season. And well, the next category, these categories are very sort of ad hoc, but like the sort of Tours de France of the late 90s, early 2000s, everyone's got their own ideas about who's the real winner, but that accolade or the actual victory is never going to be officially attributed. Everyone will go away sort of with their own ideas. Ride of the Year is the next category, and I'm going to ask for your nominations at the moment. Now, my nomination is a somber one, really, but it's an important one, I think. We all know that midway through this year, in June, at the Tour of Switzerland, Gino Maeder, the Bahrain Victorious rider, tragically lost his life in a crash on the Albula Pass. This shook the whole world of professional cycling. It certainly shook his team. And in that light, I thought and I chose for my ride of the year Matej Mohoric's performance 2 days later. He was at the Tour of Slovenia, well, riding obviously with a very, very heavy heart. Matej Mohoric actually took his first win of the season 2 days later, on the 18th of June. It was stage 5 of the Tour of Slovenia. And in fact, we asked Matej Mohoric to share his memories of that day and why it was so important to him and his team. So here is Matej Mohoric.
So obviously, what happened in Tour of Switzerland shaked all of us. We didn't know what to think, how to act, or we just freezed in that moment. And the next day we figured that we didn't know what we should do. The best way to escape that feeling was to pretend nothing ever happened and to go on our bikes and race, to take our minds off this terrible thing that we couldn't stop thinking about. And then something that helped us to evade the reality, no? Then the next day, the following day, was the last stage of Tour of Slovenia. Me personally, we had some time to think and reevaluate what we appreciate in life, reevaluate why we do cycling, why we love this sport. We also were told more about the circumstances of the crash with Gino. And personally, I decided that the best way to deal with the situation and the best way to honor Gino was to try even harder and give my best also in his honor, because he, this opportunity to prove himself on the bicycle was taken away from our friend. So we were still there to able to do that also in his honor. I felt a lot of responsibility and put a lot of pressure on myself for that stage. I did have it in my mind before the race in preparation for the tour, but it was more of a, I wouldn't say training ride, but more of a, yeah, just a part of a checklist of things to do before the tour. I didn't feel any pressure whatsoever, but then after all that's happened, I really wanted to win that race, not just because of myself, but also for Gino, and to help all team get through this difficult time together and united. Yeah, I was in deep focus the whole day. I didn't think about anything else but winning that stage. I was hyper motivated and determined more than ever. I also spoke to my teammates about that, and I inspired them to really go out there and pedal as if there was no tomorrow. And we sticked together and we made it happen. There was no other option for me, and it was probably the best on that climb. Was probably the one of the best 5 minutes efforts I will ever do in my career. But it was I almost felt as if I left my own body and just watched myself riding towards that victory. When it happened, it had a higher significance for us all, and we were then all together more determined to, we found a way to deal with the situation and honor Gino in our own way with what we know and what we love to do.
So, chaps, as I said, that was one nomination for Ride of the Year for very sort of emotional, sentimental, poignant reasons, I suppose. It was a year of lots of fantastic performances in stage races, in the classics as well. We won't necessarily get a nomination from everyone, but can we have some nominations at least? Does anyone feel strongly? Maybe Larry, you were in the peloton, you were at the bleeding edge of things there in the peloton. Maybe you witnessed a performance that particularly stands out to you as the ride of the year.
Well, again, no, this one isn't one that I witnessed, so I think I'm just going against all your recommendations. But for me, I would say one thing that really stuck out to me as a ride of the year was Tadej Pogacar in the Tour of Flanders. And I mean, okay, Pogacar is probably going to win like half of everything, right? But I just thought that was so cool, you know? I mean, again, he's kind of like tearing up the rule book of like modern cycling or whatever, you know? And like, here's a guy, you know, GC rider or whatever, Tour de France winner. And he decides like he wants to go race in the cobbles, but he's, you know, he's supposed to be a climber, but you know, he just goes and he absolutely crushes it, learned from his mistakes in the past. And, you know, I mean, just even the way the whole race happened, how they were so far behind at certain moment, you know, I can't remember if they were like 4 minutes down or what. And like, you know, to come back from this huge deficit and then win the race and everything, to me was like, it was like a just incredible race to watch. And so for me, that was probably, I would say, for me, the ride of the year. Pretty cool.
And I'll kind of tag on Larry here. Mine was going to be Pogacar for the entire season. I went through pro cycling stats, and he had twice he finished outside of, like, beyond, in Pyrenees stage two, he was 55th, and on stage three of the tour, he was 58th. If you go through his results for the rest of the year, you see a lot of ones and twos and threes and like the entire season. And because it was in one day races, it was in, you know, in grand tours and other stage races. I mean, his season looks like someone's, you know, a phenomenal rider's career, just continual top performances. And yeah, the diversity of the results in there as well.
I'm a Pogacar fan, as I've said already, but unfortunately for me, the ride of the year came from Jonas Vingegaard. I mean, his time trial performance on the Tour de France is really in the top three performances I've seen in my 35 Tour de France. I'm not a great fan of Jonas Vingegaard, but the way he really crushed, I mean, we all remember the time he took off, Wood van Aert, off Tadej Pogacar. I think we were all speechless after that race, and for me it's probably the most extraordinary performance I've seen since probably Chris Froome breakaway on the Giro, I can't really think of many, such performances on the Tour de France. It was stunning. It led some, as usual when you have these sort of performances, led to speculation on the social networks. But it was really, really, really stunning, in my opinion. Once again, not my favorite race of the day, of the year. Not my favorite rider at all. But, wow, I was really, really impressed by that. Really impressed.
It's quite hard to connect emotionally with a time trial, though, isn't it? As an exploit.
You mentioned the time trial yourself, mentioned Roglic beating Geraint Thomas on the Giro. But in that case, just looking at the figures, just the immaculate way he rode from start to finish, a guy who was, you would not have, described Vingegaard as a time trial specialist only 2 years ago. And the way he rode almost to perfection, everything was, he was in another world. It's not as exciting as man to man confrontation or anything, but once again, look at the figures, look at the way he rode, it destroyed the tour that day, and once again, I've seen very, very few such performances in my 35 tours. I was really, really impressed. In a good or in a bad way, whatever you want to think, but in the sheer sense of performance, it was extraordinary.
I was going to go down the Tour de France line with you guys, but I'm going to break away from the tour again. You can't look past that world's ride, Matthew van der Poel. Epic world championships. The race just explodes with, you've got Denmark leading it in, exploding the race, 100 and something K to go, but then van der Poel crashing, breaking his cleat, breaking his shoe, riding to the finish. Like, that was one epic Worlds, and again, a true deserved winner of that Worlds. That whole Worlds, I was glued from the start, from that protest, right to the very last sort of kilometre. That ride was just ride of the year, by far, undoubtedly.
It was van der Poel doing van der Poel things, wasn't it? And sometimes, if you don't feel sort of naturally kind of disposed towards van der Poel, your eyes can kind of glaze over a little bit. In the same way that, I was thinking some of Remco Evenepoel's rides were extraordinary. For instance, the ride after his meltdown on the Tourmalet, the fact that he came back the next day and was down the road all day and then won on his own. But you were almost completely blasé about it, because you expect that kind of thing from Remco Evenepoel. I suppose in Van der Poel's case, he was on the biggest stage as well. It was in the World Championships. But I suppose talking about emotionally connecting with performances, I struggle to connect emotionally with Van der Poel's performances sometimes, because I just expect these kind of Marvel comic book superhero performances.
I agree with that. But I think the way the race played out, it made it just that more dramatic. You had Bettiol off the front there, and was he or not? And then just the race was from so far out, sort of looked like it was going to be boring, because it was down to 10 guys already, 100K to go or whatever it was, and it just kept amping up. I was like, how can this continually keep getting better? But it just did. And then ultimately he went away and I was like, oh, okay, he's going to win. Then he crashes. His shoe breaks. You're like, oh, is he going to make it? It was just to the line.
That was that descent from the Nieuwe Quaremont in his first proper Tour of Flanders all over again, isn't it? Where he then had to chase on and make it more difficult for himself. But I also agree to a certain extent with what Daniel's saying, and just as in the position I'm sat in, trying to well, not always succeeding, but trying to say interesting things when these performances are put in. I'm running out of things to say for these guys because they are like repeat exploits, repeat fleet. You know, the Remco attacking from a million kilometres to go and just riding away. Van der Poel doing these things. And just quickly for my performance there, I'm with Larry. I was sat there on the finish line in Oudenaarde, and it's no secret that us guys don't really go to many races nowadays, but I was there. I was commentating on site for that one. And what that meant to the Flemish people, to everybody looking on, and all the things that have to go right in that race for a guy, as you said, Larry, a Grand Tour contender who's, you know, normally doing it on the bigger climbs. Each and every one of those Hellingen, you know, the little hills and the cobbled sectors, he had to be in the right place. He had to fight for that, repeated efforts on a scenario that's not his in front of those people. And those people in Belgium, I think, really appreciated that, you know, he was willing to put everything on the line by going there and doing that. I thought that was definitely the performance of the year for me in the Tour of Flanders.
I'm going to go back to something Francois said about Jonas Vingegaard being the most impressive kind of performance that he'd seen. And my suggestion is going to be a bit left field because it's the most entertaining ride, not necessarily the best performance. But did you watch the men's Madison final in the World Championships this year?
No.
Am I allowed to say that?
Daniel loves indoor cycling.
I thought that was the answer, yeah. You know, with it being like the sort of Super Worlds this year, I probably wouldn't have tuned in for that as well. But I did because it was all packaged up together. And Yuri Havik and Jan Willem van Schip. I mean, the Madison is just kind of utter chaos on the track. It's sort of part like bleep test that you did in school, sort of chess, and it's 200 odd laps. I think, you know, they tried to gain a lap at one point, they didn't succeed. It was just, you've got riders going around all over the place, but it was utterly gripping. And they worked out they needed second place in the final sprint, so they were, you know, you could see them just clinging on to this second place to win the gold. And then Jan Willem van Schip and Yuri Havik gave this one of the interviews of the year, I think, afterwards, almost like analysing every bit of the race. But in terms of like the entertainment aspect of cycling and what draws you in and has you utterly captivated by what you're watching on TV, that was the top for me. Like completely unexpected. You don't know half the people in the race. But for that sort of wow factor, that was it.
I can totally vouch for that. It was an amazing race, something I completely forgotten about, but I was again glued to my seat for that, Madison. It was amazing.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Well, let's get back to... Well, let's not get back to the cycling. Let's have another category before we conclude our second part of the review of the year. Let's look at things that took place off the bike in 2023. Maybe more into a slightly... into a journalistic realm for Francois and me and Rob and Richard. The story and the stories of 2023. Now, when I was assembling some of these today and thinking about the year that was, you know, I was sort of going back and looking through the archives and also comparing 2023 with other years and other periods in professional cycling. And it strikes me that the sort of controversies and stories these days are somewhat tamer than they were at different points, certainly in my journalistic career and yours, Francois. You compare it to sort of 10, 15 years ago, it's all sort of water pistols at dawn, whereas once upon a time it was kind of nuclear weapons. There were some good sort of controversies, beefs though, chaps, in 2023. I'm going to ask you in a minute if you have any favourites. Arnaud Démare against David Gourdou, this was the one. This was in January when Gourdou said on Discord that he didn't want to go to the tour with Démare. Apparently Démare had not wanted to get into a lift with him. Training camp. This was enjoyably petty. Another one involving Groupama, FDJ, Marc Madiot and Richard Plugger. This was at the Tour de France, of course. Plugger apparently saw Groupama, FDJ riders drinking beers on the rest day. Shock horror. Madiot quibbled over the size of these beers and said they were Perrier's. He said it's shabby, it's small and shabby of Plugger to pick holes in the drinking habits, in the rehydration habits of his riders. Stefan Urlo and Caleb Ewan, that was another one in the Tour de France. Urlo said that Ewan had sort of disrespected the Tour by abandoning, and generally wasn't very good in the Tour, was Urlo's contention. That ended in the divorce, in Ewan's divorce from Lotto Destiny. He's going to be riding for Jayco Lula next year. Antonio Tiberi versus Katz, or a cat in particular. Shouldn't be too facetious about that. Jumbo at the Vuelta. This was a cracker, wasn't it? This was one that transfixed us and entertained us for most of the Vuelta a España. And I would say this would be my favourite, because a Grand Tour is a hothouse, particularly when you're travelling with it every day. It's a sort of incubator of stories. Everything gets kind of blown out of proportion, but we all sort of revel in it and we glory in it. And being there on the ground on the race, I certainly gloried in the different permutations and machinations of this story as it played out over 3 weeks. Does anyone else enjoy this one? Jumbo at the Vuelta?
For me, it's a big one, yeah, and especially as I try to put it as diplomatically as I could on the podcast every time I've mentioned that story. I'm one of the very rare journalists or persons or cycling fans who think Sepp Kuss shouldn't have won the Vuelta. I mean, you know, because I read many times, so it's my little friend, you know, the eyes on my fingers, because it's contentions, and I don't want everybody to hate me, because he was so unanimous that, you know, Sepp Kuss is such a great guy, you know, especially from the Americans. He should, well, I mean, everything he did for the team, it's a reward for the you know, the great job he did.
Does it begin with B?
No, I think it's bullshit. I mean, in the history of Grand Tours, I don't, as I said it before, but I can't remember once when, you know, do you think Merckx or Hino or Antil would have let a teammate, you know, however dedicated, win a Grand Tour instead of them?
But did they let him win it? That's the thing.
I'll tell you something. So not me, my little friend. So let's imagine a scenario, and you'll tell me what you think. So it's the 2024 Tour de France. Last day, as you know, is a time trial, okay, between Monaco and Nice. Let's imagine Sepp Kuss is leading Jonas Vingegaard by 25 seconds. What is Jonas Vingegaard supposed to be doing? If I listen to the logics, you know, I heard during the Vuelta, he should, you know, take it easy and let Sepp Kuss win the Tour. Do you think that's what he would do? Do you think it would be logical? So if that's not logical, then the Vuelta thing was not logical. To me, you had the leader, it was Roglic. Okay, he didn't do as well as he needed to do. And then you had the stronger guy on the Vuelta. And I'm still convinced the stronger guy in the Vuelta was Jonas Vingegaard. So how come Sepp Kuss? Of those three guys, my favorite rider and my favorite person is Sepp Kuss, definitely. But in the history of cycling, that's not the way it works. You go for the leader or you go for the stronger guy. You don't go for the nicer guy. Because if that's the way you go, then we should change the rules of Grand Tours and say that if two guys are level on time, the nicer guy gets it, you know?
I'd probably win a lot more races.
That's right. Yeah, that's right, Larry. So that's that was not me. It was my little friend speaking, but that's what he thinks.
It's a hard school that you've got, or your little friend's got, isn't it? Deary me. I tell you what, though. I mean, you referred to the Tour de France. That's a time trial. It's a completely different situation. I mean, there was no danger for Jumbo-Visma.
What?
There was no danger for Jumbo-Visma. They had it sewn up. Why couldn't they decide? I mean,
if they're 1 and 2 before the final time trial, yeah. You know, I mean, you know, is Jonas going to wait for Sepp? You know, and they cross the line together. You know, as friends. Bullshit.
Larry, we've already heard that the Vuelta a España is going to conclude with a 20-something kilometre time trial. When you are 27, when you're in the red jersey in September and 25 seconds ahead of Aurélien Paris-Pandre, are you going to...
Oh, yeah, he's not winning, no, that's for sure.
Boz?
I forget, I don't think it was here that I said it, but I think Roglic caught way too much flack for all this. I mean, I guess on the Angleroo, when you look at it, when he went, he had, I think, maybe like a minute to to Sepp. He was behind. And people gave him, you know, a hard time for attacking on the Angleroo, but really it was Jonas that was actually closer on GC, and Jonas chose to follow him. You know, Jonas could have waited with Sepp and actually not gone with him. And, you know, he was more of a danger. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing was a fiasco, and I mean, they're caught between a rock and a hard place. And you know, I've listened to several interviews with Sepp since, and you know, he did win the race. But yeah, I mean, it's also a horrible situation for Roglic to be in, for, you know, Jonas to be in, and for Sepp. You know, I think in the moment, I mean, things have kind of calmed down, and obviously, you know, Roglic has left the team, and that's probably been the best thing to resolve the situation. But to a degree, I have to, you know, agree with Francois's little finger eyes. We all want to watch bike racers win the race. I mean, Sepp's a great guy. He's like one of the he's one of the nicest top contenders in the peloton. I mean, I think what he did was he also showed that he's capable of winning races in the future. You know, and I think we all sometimes forget that he was put in this situation also by his team by going up the road in that breakaway. You know, it wasn't like, you know, they were riding together in the mountains every single day, but yeah, I mean, it's a hard situation, but I do have a problemica for the year. If we want to change subject to something that
gives you problemica of the year,
yeah. Well, I mean, it's more recent, but this whole fiasco with Kian Utebrooks, and I think this will play out into the future of cycling. And I guess I'm no longer in the World Tour, so I don't really have to worry about it. But I think for so long, riders like myself and like Larry and like Mitch, you know, we're trying to seek security in the World Tour, and riders are finally starting to receive longer contracts. What's happened with this, with Kian just essentially breaking a contract? And yes, I know there's potential rumors of, you know, abuse or, I don't know, a text group that was going on behind his back, but I think that could really destabilize how riders and teams kind of operate together. And I think that, you know, it's something that we're just kind of seeing the beginning of, but it really could be an issue, I think, for something that riders have worked so hard to get, which is security in pro cycling, kind of all going out the window for, you know, which I guess, I mean, this has happened before with Van Aert, but now with Kian being such a young rider, it'll be interesting to see kind of how this may change the structure and format of contracts going forward.
Yeah, I think the legal world generally works on test cases and precedents, doesn't it? So I guess the ruling on whichever way it comes down on this case is going to be vital to see how we approach things in the next few years.
Larry, just before we conclude the part, did you hear the other day that the UCI had their seminar in Lausanne last week, and one of the figures that came out of it was that the mean average salary in the World Tour now is €449,000. That sounds a lot.
I did see that, but the median is a lot lower. Yeah. And unfortunately, I'm much under the...
No.
You guys have got it pretty good these days, haven't they?
Yeah.
But you factor.
Fortunately, I'm not bringing up the mean. Yeah.
When you talk about your mean, are you factoring in the fees you get from the cycling podcast?
Oh, surely, yeah, exactly.
Surely they nudge you up to close to that 449.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, chaps, we are into our final part of the 2023 Review of the Year Christmas episode. And before we move on, I should remind the listeners, UK-based listeners, that they can still get hold of our Grand Tour wine selections, which we sort of come up with every year in conjunction with Divine Cellars of London. If you order before 10 a.m. on Thursday in the UK, that's 10 a.m. Thursday, the 21st, obviously, you can still get those delivered to your home in the UK. That's Divine, letter D, vine.sellers.com. Now, chaps, the next category, an important category, I thought, in the vein of inspired by Time Magazine, their Person of the Year. That is an award that they give every year. This year, who knows who got the Person of the Year award this year? Do you all know?
It was Taylor Swift. Yeah.
Yes, I could rely on you, boss. I know I could rely on boss. This is a famous award, of course. Oh, not always a positive accolade. Not always rewarding, commendable behaviour. For example, Hitler got it in 1938. Josip Stalin got it in 1939. Donald Trump, 2016. But I thought, rather than talk about a rider of the year, we would have a person of the year. And before we discuss this and maybe get some nominations. I've got three very, very, very left field ideas for people of the year. People who played some role in important events or significant events in 2023. I'm going to see, I doubt that any of you will be able to tell me what their role was or who these people were. First one, Jonathan Guatibonsa. Does that name say anything, ring any bells for anyone? Jonathan Guatibonsa was a rider, the only rider who prevented Superman Lopez from taking a clean sweep, completing a clean sweep of nine stages of the Vuelta a Colombia in June.
Did he get to go to Disney World as well?
Well, in the stage that Superman Lopez didn't win, he finished second to Jonathan Guatibonsa. So I think he deserves some recognition for a curious but remarkable achievement in 2023. And Superman Lopez, who you mentioned his visit to Disneyland, did you know that he got dope tested at Disneyland? This week, I believe.
Yeah, it was an interesting Instagram post, that one, wasn't it?
Yeah. Another one, my second nomination for the left field person of the year. Larry, we discussed this individual, but you might not remember what it was about or who he was. Eric Manizabayo. Who was he in 2023? Eric Manizabayo was the Rwandan rider who asked Wout van Aert for a selfie mid-World Championship road race in Glasgow. When the peloton was stopped because of a protest, was it climate change protest? It was.
Yes. Yeah. That was brilliant, actually. That gave us 10 minutes of material. We had to fill for an hour during that. So it gave us something to talk about. Thanks, Eric.
And the final one, chaps, Mitya Mejnar. Who remembers Mitya Mejnar and can tell me what contribution he made to professional cycling in 2023? Anyone? He's a Slovenian gentleman.
Is he the gentleman who pushed Roglic up the climb?
He is.
Yeah,
The former ski jumper who just happened to be standing at the roadside when Primoz Roglic's chain slipped in the decisive final time trial of the 2023 Giro d'Italia. I never really understood, never got to the bottom of whether he had been sort of planted there by Jumbo-Visma, whether Roglic even knew or recognised him, remembered him. I'm not entirely sure. Anyway.
It's kind of a conspiracy theory, isn't it? That it just this guy happened to be there as the chain fell off.
Very much.
It's probably something like on the dark web devoted to it, isn't there? Like a chat room with a load of conspiracy theories.
Very much so. So, chaps, that brings us to our person of the year. I'm going to go first. My nomination, my suggestion, talking of Primoz Roglic, Jumbo-Visma, my nomination for person of the year would be Richard Plugger, the boss, the CEO of Jumbo-Visma, not only because the team completed this grand slam of three grand tours, but because Richard Plugger was a bit of a lightning rod in for sort of good and ill in 2023. He was the pretty contentious and at times divisive, unpopular AIGCP president. In the last couple of weeks, he's been called a thief by Cedric Vasseur for the Kian Utebrooks saga, or having lured him away from Bora Hansgrohe. It was, of course, his war of words with Mark Madio, saying that beer was poison and a substance that shouldn't be touched by any professional cyclist. There was the merger, the biggest nothing burger of 2023, the merger that never happened with Sudal Quickstep. So I think Richard Plugger, more than anyone else, he is the sort of emblematic, the symbolic figure of 2023. Does anyone else have any ideas or suggestions?
Well, as I said at the beginning of this podcast, you know, Pogacar will be my personality of the year, of this year, probably next year, probably the year after, and as long as he rides, you know, because he's really the most exciting rider I've seen in many, 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 many years. So I'll go for Tadej every year.
I'll jump on the back of that, because, you know, I'm going to be really boring and say the same thing, Pogacar, because look, his season is so round, you know, first Flanders, second at the Tour, Lombardia, Flesch, Amstel, third at the Worlds, remember as well, wins Pro Nice. Like, that's just so round as a GC guy. We don't see that anymore. I think since the Lance days, since he created this new way of going about the Tour. But the thing that why he gets Person of the Year the most for me is because he's bringing the human element back. He's diffusing the whole robotic thing about it. To his detriment, potentially, riding on the rest day with a baguette in his pocket, doing a backflip into the swimming pool on the rest day of the Tour de France. I guess he probably copped a bit of slack from the team for that when he didn't win the Tour, but who cares? You know, he's just doing it. He's living his life. Look, I've just seen recently the Matt Preston coffee ride video with him. He's just a good character. Takes the camera into his house, doing monos in the middle of the street, and he's just bringing the human element back. That's what I love about him, apart from what Francois said. He's just so dominant.
I mean, Mitch, what you say about, well, his sort of, his persona on social media particularly, but even the other day when the Giro d'Italia announced that he was going to their race in 2024, you know, I tried and struggled and couldn't imagine Jonas Vingegaard, for example, even playing ball with that sort of thing. And you might say that participating in videos like that and that kind of, you know, social media campaign, participating in the hype around him and almost encouraging the hype around him, that could be to his detriment, couldn't it? I mean, in terms of a sort of a narrative being built that he's not as focused as Vingegaard. But in the long run, in terms of his sort of the mark that he leaves on the sport, it's a force for good, isn't it?
It's like you think of a young kid who's trying to follow the sport and get into it. I think that can connect to the character of Tadej more than, say, Vingegaard. You know, it's just something exciting. It brings, you know, a really fun element to it. And I think, when I think about my own son or, you know, kids older than that, that's what they want to do. Get out there and race and be human, you know, for lack of a better word.
It seems to me as well that he's starting a kind of a collection of wins. He wants to win all the monuments. And in that sense, my impression is that next year's the Giro would probably be his number one goal because he's already won the Tour. You see what I mean? He seems he wants them all, you know, the whole list, the World Tour, you know, calendar on his, you know, record at the end of his career. So that's also an exciting thing.
I worry about one thing, François. The extent to which he's going to be love bombed by Italy and the Italians. We've talked about this on the podcast before. They are so unbelievably flattered and enamored when a big foreign star comes to the Giro d'Italia, and every interview we'll start with a question about how much they love Italy and how much they love pizza and how much they love pasta, and it's going to be really, really tedious. I'd just like to prepare you for that.
I had Richard Pluga as well. I think he would definitely be the Person of the Year just because he was so instrumental in so many parts of the season. But I would like to make an honorable mention for Adam Hansen, who's taken over the CPA. I mean, I was in the World Tour for, I guess, 7 years, and I never saw Johnny Bugno one time. I think they still owe me several thousand euros for my retirement fund. But, you know, just having seen all the articles and having seen Adam Hansen and talked to him at the Tour de France this year, I mean, to see the CPA actually involved in the sport. And I know sometimes there's been some, you know, controversy and he is trying to change things. And oftentimes that's, you know, an uphill battle and it's slow moving. Maybe Larry could speak to this, but for the first time, I have actually seen the CPA pretty involved in, you know, day-to-day conversations that are taking place in the men's peloton.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely second that. I think that's a really good honorable mention because, like, really, it's the first time I've ever felt like the CPA is actually doing something, and like Adam is like very present and available, and yeah, really trying to make a difference, and that's really cool. I will say that also. I kind of wanted to have Teddy Pogacar also, but I didn't know if that was cool. And randomly, I also passed Pogacar when he was doing that podcast with Matt Stevens. Kind of funny.
Of course you did. Chaps, Larry, and maybe you, Ian, and also anyone else, just on the Pluga and my nomination of Pluga, does he deserve the most credit of everyone at Jumbo-Visma? I mean, he's obviously kind of the architect. We had him on the podcast for a long interview last year where he talks to us about the sort of genesis of the Jumbo-Visma empire, I suppose you could call it now. But Marijn Zeeman, for example, the head coach, he's someone who I think most people in the sport think is a great mind and may even be sort of more instrumental in the success they've had than Richard Plugger. Or a third sort of name I'd suggest put forward, and Primoz Roglic as a talismanic figure that the team is now going to lose. And it strikes me that there is this sort of hint of kind of hubris in some of what's been going on around the team over the last couple of months, and Plugger, this, you know, the breakaway league, the merger, you know, there might be a suspicion that he's sort of getting ideas above his station. And it strikes me that Roglic has been a sort of grounding force in this project as well. Roglic's sort of stoicism is a kind of, well, to employ a term that Francois might use, a kind of bullshit antidote, and they will miss they will miss Roglic for that reason as well.
I mean, I guess I got in trouble for talking about Team Sky Ineos the other day about Rod, but I mean, in a way, there's a lot of resemblance to kind of the decline of Ineos, you know. And I think Brailsford at the time got a lot of credit for that team. And I think, you know, when you look at any kind of CSO or CEO or, like, you know, boss of a team, you know, oftentimes their job and why they're successful is they put the right people in the right places. So essentially that's their focus, is putting, you know, whether it's Zeeman or, you know, different coaches, staff, riders, you know, they're overseeing everything and kind of bringing it all together. But like every great empire, you know, they start to fall, and Roglic leaving could be like an instrumental part. You know, you look at the team where they were, I guess, in 2020, you know, when they almost won the tour with Primoz, you know, a lot of those riders are gone. You know, Dumoulin's gone, now Primoz is gone. You know, at some point, you know, someone will catch them and be on top once more.
Boswell slams Jumbo-Visma. I can see the headlines tomorrow.
I think like, if for my take on it, you know, I think he probably did make a lot of positive change, but I think, you know, it's kind of a... Yeah. Yeah, Plugger. I mean, but I think, you know, he's a guy who comes with like a business background and maybe not a background in cycling, if I'm correct. And like, you know, essentially put in probably some pretty basic business principles and like good practices, which in general in cycling just wasn't really that in place. Okay, maybe with Team Sky, everything like that. But, you know, I think he took over an organization that was kind of like, you know, at the bottom and was open to change. And I think it was probably that spirit of being open to change that allowed all that like progression to happen. And, you know, I think it was just kind of like a positive spiral. And so, yeah, I mean, maybe, you know, he's to thank for a lot of it, but yeah, I guess it definitely wouldn't have been all him. You know, I mean, there's obviously other parts, yeah, like getting Roglic and stuff like that. Maybe it was a bit of luck, but yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of progression that can still happen in cycling. And I think he just, you know, took over an organization that was ripe for progress. So yeah.
And I guess I'll just add one more thing on that. I mean, for the longest time, and I guess this was when you look at Sky in their heyday, you know, they really couldn't make a misstep. You know, at some point the fans and journalists kind of were against them. And I guess that's to a degree what's happening now at Jumbo. But there's been very little controversy. Everything's been on the upward trajectory. And, you know, you look at the controversies that they've been in this year, kind of resembles a lot of, you know, I guess when kind of Sky was transitioning to Ineos, and a lot of those, you know, obviously with the salbutamol thing with Froome and, you know, the whole fiasco with Wiggins, you know, there was kind of these murmurs came up after, you know, they kind of had reached the top. And there are a lot of similarities in kind of the trajectory of where Sky went and when they became Ineos and kind of where Jumbo has come from and where they are now.
You know, I think that's true. Okay, chaps, well, we'll go with Richard Plugger as our man of the year. He'll have to pose on a magazine cover with his cat draped over his shoulders, a la Taylor Swift. And we will go with Adam Hansen for our... what did we say? Adam Hansen, honourable mention. Larry, we're going to have to say goodbye to you in a minute because you're still at training camp. You've got to get, you've got to think about your sleep score. Mitch as well. I think you've got to take your kids to school. But before we say goodbye to you, chaps, a lot of goodbyes in 2023. I'll just list a few of them. Annemiek van Vleuten, I said this was, we're going to concentrate on men's cycling today, but she obviously is very notable. Farewell in 2023. Peter Sagan, Daniel Oss, Matej Bodnar, Thibaut Pinot, José Joaquín Rojas, Imanol Erviti, Mathieu Ladagnou, Nasser Bueni, Jos van Emden, Tony Galopin, Greg Van Avermaet, Darrell Impey, Maxime Bouet, the list goes on. Anyone, chaps, that you would particularly like to wax lyrical about, send out, send off, you two, Mitch, Larry, any of those chaps that you've had experience with that you'd like to pay tribute to?
Well, two you didn't mention are like Mika Sherrell and Mickey Scher, who were both like my teammates. And I don't know, I would say like I turned pro with Mickey. And I had like a lot of like nice experience with him. He taught me a lot when I was a Neo Pro. And then I did the last few years with him too. So I'll miss him, but he's going to be a director at Trek this year. So I guess I'll still be seeing him around. And then, yeah, Mika Sherrell, it was like nice to have him in the team these last few years. He's a super nice guy. He also lives down in the south of France. And so I'm also sure I'll be seeing him around. But yeah, both those guys, I'll definitely miss having them in the bunch and having them in the team to talk to and shoot the shit with a bit. So those guys will both be missed from me.
Yeah, I'd probably say, Darrell Impey, you know, a close friend of mine, a guy that I lived with in Girona and raced with on Green Edge, and almost like welcome to the afterlife, mate. Welcome to the new world. He's moving out to Sydney, Sydney, Australia. Welcome to the afterlife, exactly. The better life. So he's out in Sydney, Australia. So, you know, not really around the corner, but at least in the same country. Yeah, I think it's a really interesting phase for, you know, ex-athletes, especially professional cyclists, this next phase, and it's really interesting to see where they go, you know, in terms of what business ventures or, you know, how they handle it mentally, and you know, that'll be really interesting. Another guy I don't know that well, but I really sort of always crossed paths a lot with, was Maxime Bouet. Him and I raced together back at Tour de l'Avenir, and it's sort of weird, one of those guys you have your whole career with, you're there at the very beginning and you keep crossing paths the whole time. So I always had an eye for him, even though we didn't have much to do with each other. To see him retire, I know he was there from the beginning of my career. We turned pro at the same time and blah, blah, blah. He's now finishing his career. So, you know, welcome to the afterlife.
On that note, chaps, I'm going to release you into the wild.
Thank you.
And wish you a very Merry Christmas. Probably a hot one for you, Mitch. Hopefully a recuperative one for Larry, is looking, as I said, a little bit tired. But we expect big things from Larry in 2024, Grand Tour victories and so on and so forth. So Merry Christmas, chaps, and thanks for everything you've done for us in 2023.
Thanks guys.
Everyone. Enjoy. It's been a pleasure.
And that leaves Ian Boswell, Richard Abraham, Rob Hatch, François Thomazot. I think that's all of us, isn't it? Five of us left. Suddenly there were five. Chaps, that's about it as regards review of the year. I did send out an invitation on the group before we started recording today, thinking about how everyone's going to be spending the next couple of weeks, a bit more downtime than they usually have maybe over the Christmas period. I asked you whether you had any recommendations, sporting or not. Books, podcasts, films, documentaries, anything you've particularly enjoyed in 2023, ways in which people might like to spend their time over the next couple of weeks. Anyone got any?
There's something that I've found myself rewatching. I've watched it before, but The Trip with Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, just as an insight into what life is sometimes like on the road.
Tell people, so this is a show that is only comes out in the UK, isn't it?
I think, well, it's on Sky and Netflix, I think, okay. Some of it. There's and been several series.
For international listeners, tell them what it is.
For international listeners, it's Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, two well-known comedians here in the UK, who, it's a sort of fly-on-the-wall, exaggerated version of themselves, and they go on a trip to dine out at various restaurants. The first one set in the UK, and then they go to Italy and Spain, Greece.
It's a bit like a good cycling podcast without the cycling.
with a lot more kind of Michael Caine impressions and just a lot more impressions in general. But just as a, in the way that sort of lots of things happen but nothing happens, and there's the sort of relationships between people on the road, I find those two quite funny and very compelling viewing, seeing their sort of interactions, and see a lot of, when you get to, you know, third week of a grand tour, or spending a long time on the road with people, a lot of those sort of the ways that characters can brush up against each other and deal with little inconveniences and so on.
Oh, now here the trip and the cycling podcast veer apart because it's perfect harmony at all times in the cycling podcast car. François, maybe we could read one of your books.
I actually finished translating into English one of my novels. It's being sub-edited by, native English writers to make it more, probably more literary or whatever. It's a crime novel called Marseille Confidential. So, who knows? It might be published in English in 2024. It would be great. I've also started working on a couple of books directly in English on cycling, but I can't say much more for now. Also, because we didn't bid farewell to Thibaut Pinot except by saying, that is now, as you say, PSG hooligan, which is a bit of a pain for me because I like Thibaut very much, but I hate Paris Saint-Germain. And so thanks, Mitch, to mention Max Bouet because he's from Marseille, like me. But this is an insider information. I know that Thibaut will be working on a book, not an autobiography, but he's been approached by a publisher specialized in nature. And so they make books with celebrities about their relationship with nature. And obviously, as we know, Thibaut likes his goats and his donkeys and his, strollers in the countryside. So he might be writing on that, shortly. So,
François, so far you've recommended a book that's still being subbed, a book that might come out in 2024.
Is there anything that's out yet?
And a book that might come out.
That's right. That's things to look forward to, which is interesting as well. But if you haven't made your Christmas present or gifts yet, and you want to improve your French, I would recommend. Dans la Musette is one of the few interesting French cycling websites and Twitter accounts. Dans la Musette, they're called, and they have a book out called Le Tour de la France, and it's kind of Le Tour de France seen from a kind of a funny point of view. It's full of silly stories and silly little facts like things we like. So it's of course it's in French, but it's called Le Tour de la France by Dans la Musette, and you can buy it online for the French readers, or if you want to read in French a little bit, why not?
Ian?
I am reading a book at the moment. It probably doesn't pertain to anyone else listening. I believe it's called Populating Vermont, and it's essentially just around how Vermont was trying to be populated. I guess I'd also just like to give a huge shout out to the cycling podcast. I noticed a dramatic increase in my training volume whenever a grand tour is going on, just because I do listen to this podcast, more so than anything else. And, I know that Lionel's not always a huge fan of these longer form episodes, but the more we record and the longer they are, the more time I spend on my bike riding. So, maybe longer podcast than next year.
And finally, to you, Rob Hatch, although from your facial expression, I got the sense that you weren't prepared for this question.
Sorry, teacher. I was up at 5 a.m. this morning. I've been on two flights. I've done my best Terry Wogan impression of the world of presentation. I do, however, have a lovely book sitting right next to me on the desk. It's called The Best There Never Was by Daniel Freiber about Jan Ullrich. I won't give out any podcast recommendations apart from this one, because to be honest, given the state of the world at the minute, they've mainly been news and things like that, and I'm probably advised not consuming any more of that at the minute.
I did just recently, the podcast I sometimes browse is Bill Maher, American comedian, does a podcast called Club Random, where he usually gets high and has some drinks with guests or celebrities, and Lance was a recent guest on his podcast. Didn't reveal anything too I guess, new for any of us cycling fans. But yeah, Daniel, you may enjoy that.
I will enjoy that, I'm sure. Just a couple from me, a couple of things I've enjoyed in 2023. On the sort of sports documentary front, I watch a lot of sports documentaries. And Boom Boom, Alex Gibney's two-part Boris Becker documentary. A lot of parallels between Boris Becker and Jan Ullrich, but that was a cracking watch. Really, really entertaining. Boris Becker, a very, very entertaining character, I would say. And podcast series one I particularly enjoyed was called Missed Fortune, about the a buried treasure in the United States, a sort of a collector, a very rich collector philanthropist who created this riddle which beguiled thousands, tens of thousands of people in the United States. They went looking for his lost treasure over years and decades. And Missed Fortune, the podcast series, tells the story of how obsessed people became trying to find this this buried treasure in the American wilderness. So that'd be my recommendation, something to sort of spend a few hours doing, consuming over the festive period. But chaps, that concludes, I think, our review of the year Christmas episode. I would like to thank you, just as I thanked Mitch and Larry, for your wonderful input in 2023. Hopefully there'll be more from all of you in 2024. Just a couple more thanks to people who have contributed to the podcast this year. Lionel couldn't join us today, unfortunately, because he has COVID. We were supposed to have a Christmas message from Lionel, third time this year, I believe. I've got a Christmas lunch with Lionel in 2 days. He's hopeful that he'll be better by then, but I am doubtful. Anyway, thanks of course to Lionel. Thanks to our sponsors, Map, Science and Sport. Thanks to Audio Boom, who sort of hosts our data, and they do more than just that for us. They are the sort of the switchboard, the mothership for the cycling podcast. Thanks to our producers, Hugh Owen, Will Jones, Tom Wally, John Mooney and Adam Bowie, who do invaluable work for us all year. And thanks also to David Luxton, who also does a lot for us behind the scenes on the business front. And chaps, on that note, I am going to wish you a very, very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. And we will be hearing from you all in the new year.